Hey, everybody, on this episode of Inside the Documentary, we're getting up close and personal with filmmakers Nyasa Nahinan and David Ring. Let's do it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Inside the Documentary.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Inside the Documentary right here on Popcorn Talk. This is the show where we get up close and personal with the people that bring all those great documentaries to the big screen, your TV set, or maybe if you're watching them on your mobile streaming device. I'm your host, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. Now, my guests today aren't just filmmakers. They're also married. Look at that. They've been working in television and film, but their main focus has been documentaries. So their documentaries have been through different festivals. They've been in theaters, TV screens, gone to great critical acclaim, and they're here today to promote their latest film, School Life, which documents a year in the life of a boarding school in Ireland. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Nyasa Nahinan and David Ring. Please tell me how close I was to that name.
Very close.
Oh, yeah,
no,
so
that was
close.
Perfect. No, seriously, that was perfect. Oh, I wouldn't change it at all.
Oh, thank you. Oh, well, all right. I'll take that. I was sweating it so badly. So badly. So first I want to start off a little bit about you two there. So interesting to find it was film and individual pursuit for both of you, and is that what kind of brought the two of you together?
Well, I started as an actor. Okay. I trained as an actor and acted for a while and then became a director in theatre and was doing a lot of activist theatre, which was great, you know, in South Africa, political theatre. And then when I moved, I had to go into exile to avoid national service, the draft in South Africa, and moved to London. I started doing more theatre there and then moved to Ireland. And so theatre was my first love and my first passion.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So what about you?
I went to art college and trained as a textile designer, and I came over here to the US, and I worked in New York for a couple of years, and it was my creative director, Cynthia Weber, who was the first person who kind of switched me on to the idea of the moving image. She worked in advertising, and she used to get me to do some of her storyboards for concept boards for like perfumes and stuff like that. And so that was kind of my first little taste of film. So I kind of meandered my way into film after going through book publishing, design, moved back to Ireland, and then started working in the art department in feature films. So that was, and then David hired me
I made a clean jump from theater to film. I said, okay, you know, I want to do something different. I was in my early 30s, and I went back to University of London, moved back from Ireland to London to do a master's in film directing, film and television directing. So for me, it was a very clear decision. I didn't meander in the way that Nyasa did.
And so for you, I mean, leaving South Africa for that, what was it like to leave home and come over to first the UK and then head over to Ireland? Was it was any of your family still back there in South Africa?
Oh, they were all there. Yeah,
okay.
They were all there. And it was the worst years of apartheid. I went to university there, and I was involved in quite a lot of political theater against the apartheid regime. And there was compulsory conscription there. So if you were a white male, you either went straight after school or straight after university to the army. You had no choice. So I wasn't going to do that. So luckily, I was born in Britain. So I had a British passport, so I could leave and go into exile. But it meant I couldn't go back. It was difficult. Couldn't go back to see my parents, my brother or sister.
Yeah, what, were your brother and sister older or younger than you?
I had an older brother and a younger sister, and they were still in South Africa at the time.
So did you, and your brother, he did not have to worry about conscription?
Oh, actually, my brother went back. He left before the time that you could do. So he left at 16.
Okay.
He's 4 years older than me. Went back to England. So he missed it, and then he came back and went to work with my dad in South Africa. So I'm not quite sure how he managed that, but he managed to avoid the draft by disappearing, and then before he was called up, I went after I got the papers, or yeah. I was told you're going to be called up, and then I thought, okay, no way, I'm leaving. So
was it, because I mentioned many of your friends not as fortunate as you to be able to...
No, exactly, and a very, very close friend of mine who Nasser and I collaborate with, and he's a writer, Etienne Essery, and he actually did his military service. It's compulsory 2 years, and then they call you back every year for 8 years to do 3 more months. And he said, no way. You know, he was sent to, very traumatic for him. He was sent to the Angolan border. He had to see people being killed. You know, it was just not, you know, I'm sure very similar to what a lot of Americans have experienced in, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he just said, no, I'm not doing this. And he objected, and he was one of the first military conscientious objectors for political reasons to the military, and he was sent to prison. So I have a friend who had a really the other extreme, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Doing activist theater, though, is that, I can't imagine that is not a very safe thing to pursue down there. Is it just a lot of doing activist theater, not very, people, I mentioned the government, not very thrilled about that.
It was dangerous, but I was young and naive and impulsive, and you feel quite protected as a white person in South Africa, you know, even if you're against the apartheid regime. So, you know, I went into black townships working with these political theater groups, and they were often arrested and, you know, violently assaulted in police stations in South Africa, and I wasn't. So I felt kind of like safe, which, you know, wasn't necessarily the case. But, when you've come through that system, you feel like you've got that kind of protection. Afterwards, years later, I realized that I was actually, you know, not safe at all. You know, that there were many, many activists against the apartheid regime who were sent to prison, you know, who were detained without charge, without trial. So, so it was an interesting time.
When were you able to return?
I returned after Mandela was released. So, you know, in the late 90s.
And when you were over in the UK or Ireland, did you have a family there, or is it...
No, I had, because I was born in Britain, I had a grandmother and uncles and aunts and that kind of,
So then you hire Nyasa, and was there immediately just like a spark between the two of you? Like, this is somebody that kind of thinks the same way that I do. It'd be great to collaborate with them. And then perhaps, why not get married if we're there?
Yeah.
Well, there was a spark, but nothing happened, because I think there was another lingering relationship, really, at that time. So it took a few months, and then we got together, and then I think you asked me to come and research a documentary project with you, and I had just been doing back-to-back films, because, you know, when you freelance, you never turn
That's
anything
right.
down.
You can't say no.
I'll never work again. So I had enough money in the bank to kind of take a little break. And that was a film about refugees who were coming to Ireland for the first time in 1999, and it was something that Ireland hadn't seen before, because we were flourishing as a country, you know, on the sort of in the economic sense, and that was it. That was, I never went back to the fiction world. I stayed in documentary after that experience.
Because since you kind of let her into this world, what was it about you, David, that kind of said, like, I'd like to be more involved in documentaries?
I think because I came from that background of becoming more politically aware and socially aware, that was always there. So even when I worked in theater, I was doing quite a lot of, I don't know, activist is not the right word, but I did theater productions on substance abuse, and we took them to teenagers, to schools and youth groups, and tried to raise awareness about the risks, the dangers. And so I think that was already there, and then when I went to study film, although I was interested in fiction, I had that awareness that really I was going to finally move into some either socially politically aware fiction, you know, the Ken Loach, you know, that kind of domain, or else I would move into documentary. And the reason for going to documentary was that fiction was so damn hard to break into. And I thought, well, do I want to do 10 years as a trainee assistant director, moving up, you know? And NASA, funnily enough, had in parallel been doing, she had done all that. She'd gone through the trainee art direction, up climbing the ladder. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to tell stories, and I want to be telling them now. So the first film I made was actually a political film about Mexico, about the Zapatista regime in Chiapas. In Mexico. That was before I met Nyasa.
Okay, so now, because I know with school life, it's more of an observational documentary. Has that been kind of like the style that you prefer, or is it just this particular film that kind of lent itself to this? approach?
Well, I think, like, for me, because I sort of meandered my way into the world, I had never really studied film. So I was lucky enough to be accepted onto a sort of a short-term course that was being run in Ireland, and it was run in a hotel in the middle of nowhere. And what they did was they invited these incredible directors like D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus came, and Kim Longanoto, and you know, and they were all of them had like a different style. But for me, when I saw Kim Longanoto's sort of work, I thought, oh my God, that, you know, that is the voice that I want to emulate, this idea of observational filmmaking. And from there, that was the first film I made on my own, was that David produced, was about, you know, a 70-year-old farmer living in the northwest of Ireland, and he was like a bachelor, and there was this like collective fantasy over who was going to inherit the farm. So I made a film about this, and it was completely observational, and so it was something that's always stayed close to me. So I always aspire to making observational films. It doesn't always work out, because not every story suits that sort mm-hmm. of mode, and it requires a lot of time.
Now, as I listened to another interview that you did with a gentleman from Canada, I believe. I was listening to that interview that you did. Yes, uh-huh. Where you're talking about just like the challenges of an observational technique is that you don't have a clear narrative, and who knows how long it might take before you can find the narrative when it comes to you. Mm-hmm. Taking an approach with observational narrative, have you kind of talked yourself out of that and tried to do a different method just because you feel like we don't have the time to necessarily kind of just observe and see what happens?
No, well, I mean, I think initially when, like, the whole idea of, like, direct cinema started, you know, they would go into stories and there'd be no research, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't work, and usually they relied on this crisis mode for, you know, for a story to mm-hmm. unfold. Whereas, like, I think, like, for our approach is more like we do a lot of research. You know, you do kind of figure out who your potential characters are. You imagine, like, for getting funding, you have to write very detailed, you know, treatment. It's all fiction because you're imagining what it is that you're going to capture, but it's all based on the research that you've done. So we had, like, you know, we knew we would have the year in the life of the school to hang the film on. We thought John and Amanda were going to retire. There was certainly talk about it in our research phase. Amanda was actively looking for a house to buy. But then that didn't happen. But, you know, retirement was always looming because, you know, John is 70, Amanda was 69 at the time. So you would imagine that they were going to retire. But then, you know, John wasn't able to retire because he can't, because yes. he lives for children. That's, you know, that's who he is. You know, without children, take children out of his life, and you know, he doesn't have anything that really to live for. So
well, what I during that interview that you mentioned that the two of you had very different boarding school experiences. Yours, since you came over from South Africa, it just kind of taken away from your family, just not the most pleasant of experience to find yourself in. And you had a much more enjoyable time.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like the idea, like, oh, it'd be kind of, was that basically just as you were kind of comparing notes, thinking like, this might be an interesting angle to take on this?
Well, my experience was, it was before South Africa. My parents were working in Nigeria, and they sent my brother and I back to the UK. He was 11, I was 7. He probably got on a bit better than me. 11-year-old understands reasons why parents are doing that, and I perhaps didn't understand. So I found it quite difficult and quite traumatic. But it definitely, when the opportunity came to make the film about Headford, which is the last primary boarding school in Ireland, taking children from 7 to 13, which is the age I went to boarding school, it had huge resonance, and NASA had a boarding school experience, a more positive one. But
yeah, I mean, I went as a day pupil to a boarding school like Headford, you know, because we lived next door to it. So I had, you know, and I probably read an awful lot of Mallory Towers and, you know, St. Clair's Enid Blyton books. So, like, I had this kind of, you know,
so did I.
Very idyllic view of what boarding school would be like. So when it came to when I was 11 and I was ready to go to high school, I, you know, elected to go to a boarding school.
It was an hour from home.
Yeah,
and
Dad
went in, you know, once a week to take a cake in and, you know, and that kind of thing. You know,
oh, must be nice.
I was lucky. I had my grandparents and uncle and aunt living quite close to the school, but I didn't see my parents from one year to summer. Summer holidays was the only time I saw them, really.
Yeah, but we were interested in what the 21st century boarding school would look like. And I think, like, you know, schools have changed dramatically. You know, children and their emotional well-being are much more at the focus of schools day and boarding schools. So we were kind of interested in this whole idea of, like, is there such a thing as a surrogate family? Because an awful lot of these schools pitch themselves as, you know, the surrogate type mm-hmm. family. But we didn't really know if that was actually a reality or not. And that was kind of a big question for us when we sort of set about making this film. Is there such a thing?
I want to ask follow up on that for 1 second. But originally, because you mentioned that it's like the last primary mm-hmm. boarding school, is that something that has just been phased out over the years? And Edwards Land, like the kind
yeah,
of the last
there wouldn't
one?
Have been that many primary boarding schools anyway in Ireland, unlike UK, where they call them prep schools in the UK, and there are 400 or 500 schools like Hedford that take children from as young as 4. To 13. So in Ireland, they're probably, I'm guessing, maybe only 5 or 6, you know, going back 20, 30 years. And yes, they were sort of phased down. It became less popular. Parents were probably thinking, well, I don't know if it's the right thing to do to send children away at that young age. Also, the economy was up and down. We had a few crashes. People couldn't afford it. So yeah, Hedford became the last boarding school for that age in the whole of Ireland.
Well, now, you mentioned that it gave you a question about what boarding schools would be like in the 21st century. When you're approaching any documentary, whether it be School Life or something else like The Strangers or Book Smugglers, it's something about having a question that kind of gnaws at you, that you feel like this is a question that's worthy enough for me wanting to invest these several years to kind of find out the story.
I don't know that you think about investing that amount of time. You
we
think
thought it'd be quicker.
we're prepared to spend time, and we mm-hmm. have with most of our films. We spend, you know, 6 months a year at least filming and gathering the material.
And raising the funding, that's the hardest part, is raising the funding and making people believe that the story you want to tell is, you know, worthy of being told.
Are you able to rely, I don't want to say rest on your laurels, but let your past work speak for you when you're seeking funding? Or is it basically you're always starting over?
You're pretty much starting over. Yeah. Mm. I mean, of course, you know, we have a reputation. We've been making docs together for 15 years. So in Ireland, particularly, the funding bodies would know us. But then they know 20, 30 other people who are competing for that same very small slice of the pie. The budget for documentary in Ireland is tiny. But, you know, I'm not going to say it's bad, because I know in America it's even worse. You know, you guys don't really have, I think you have National Endowment for the Arts, and you have a few places, but American, you see them on the American docs, it's always this long list of patrons and friends and family who've donated money. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're in Europe, we're not too badly off, so we're not going to complain about that. But you can't rely on, oh, well, David and Nass's last film premiered at a great festival in Europe, therefore we're going to give them money for the next. It's mm. always down to the strength of the idea, mm. you know, and that's how it should be. It mm-hmm. should be about, you know, is this great storytelling? You know, are there great characters? Is it a unique place? And the challenge with Hedford was to try and convince people that a film about a private school with two elderly people retiring was interesting, because they were going, okay, private school, boring. Retirement, boring, you know, we don't want to fund a film like this. So we battled. It was a struggle. You know, it took us the best part of the 2 years. We were pretty much at the end of the first year of filming. We filmed for 2 years, and at the end of the first year of filming, before we really had the money in place. So big commitment and big risk.
But in a sense where you have to have confidence in your idea that we are going to start researching, we're going to start shooting, and have the confidence in ourselves and the idea that we will get the funding at some point through the process.
Yeah.
So, speaking of research, you actually moved down by Hedford, and your children, you have a son and daughter, they actually attended that while mm-hmm. you were doing the research for this.
Yeah.
What's it like when you kind of do research on a boarding school? So, I mean, you're looking at alumni, you're reaching out to them.
Mm-hmm.
Are a lot of them local, or are they scattered all around the world?
No, we were lucky that a retired headmaster had just written a book about Hedford. So one of our first experiences was going to the book launch. And we didn't know anybody in the school, really, bar the headmaster, who we had met. And the room was full of about maybe 400 people.
Mm.
And, I mean, the love in that room was unbelievable. Like, we were like, Jesus, you know. And they were reading out letters from past pupils, you know, Spanish kids, French kids, you know, who'd all been to the school. And, like, it was really moving. It was really, like, it was quite astounding. And then later on in that year, they celebrated some, I don't know, what was it, some 50 years or 55 years of the school being, you know, open. And no, it was longer than that. It must have been 65 or 70 maybe, years. Yeah. And so we took that opportunity to speak to an awful lot of alumni who had traveled over to be part of this celebration. And we listened to their stories. And so we spoke to 50-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 30-year-olds, and we asked them, like, what was your experience like? And there were two names that kept cropping up, and that was John and Amanda Layden. And spoken about
with huge affection, absolutely, always, love,
yeah,
and affection.
Yeah, the mark that they had left on them. And then at that time, John and Amanda had zero interest in us as filmmakers or in the idea of a film being made about the school. Like, they just kind of gave us a wide berth, really. And so it took a little while for that sort of door to open. And I guess it was a combination of, like, when you asked about the research project, we could see the changes in our own children. We could see how they were transformed over that first year. And it was like a light bulb being switched on for both of them. And they're both very different characters. And so it was a combination of that. And then, you know, hearing all the stories. And then, you know, finally John and Amanda sort of saw that we were really serious about making a film in the school, and they invited us over to their house for a cup of tea, and we were able to talk about, like, what we saw, and then they told us what Headford was to them. And then about a week later they came back to us and they said, okay, you know, if you're going to make this film, we're in.
That is, mm-hmm, because they are two really interesting characters, mm-hmm, just right from the top. John with his hair that is just always just kind of going everywhere all the time.
It's like a Dr. Seuss character.
Yes. And as I like to see, he's talking to one student about his and Amanda's relationship, where it's like, oh, we said we'd stay together until the money ran out.
Yeah.
Just
this dry, sardonic sense of humor all the time. And the kids sometimes, like, it takes the kids, like the younger kids, they don't get him. They're like, you know, who is this? But he doesn't teach the younger kids. Like, he likes them when they're a little bit older, when he can really have a banter with them. So when they get to 11 and 12, and that's when they get John Layden. So by that time, they've totally got him. Like, yeah. And they, you know, and he just keeps pressing buttons and, you know, trying to get them to, you know, be confident, you know, kids.
Which I think those are the fun teachers, the ones that, you know, they have that sense of playfulness and mischievousness, mm, about them. That just kind of, I think as a kid, you really respond to that. Mm. Where you don't feel like it's that, like, that kind of very dry kind of, you know, just think, you know, teacher, you're like, no, oh, all right, they're not going to crack a smile. They're not going to poke fun at me at all. Mm.
Yeah.
I really enjoy that. I wanted, before we talk more about the film, though, I want to talk about one shot that just right out of the gate I loved. And that was just the tracking shot from them getting out of the house, getting into the car, and driving, mm, to the,
yeah,
school.
Yeah.
Mm. That shot, I've gone back and watched that shot many times, because that, mm, is such, where did the idea come for that shot? I just love,
well,
that.
Yeah. You know, Headford's an 18th century house. It's like Harry Potter world, you know, and it's a really unique environment, and we wanted to stay within that environment for the filming. Now, quite a lot of the teachers live in the grounds, so Dermot Dix, the headmaster, has a house in the woods, in the grounds, and a couple of other teachers, and John and Amanda live in that little bungalow cottage in the grounds as well. So to stay in that world of a school for our film, we thought, how do we connect John and Amanda with the school? How do we let people know that their house is in the grounds? They're right there. Their whole lives they've lived in the grounds of the school. And we tried, you know, following John and Amanda as they drove to school, and the road's really bumpy, so all the cameras are going like this. Right.
John doesn't perform, so he was never going to slow down. So
yeah. Oh yeah, the whole film was completely observational, so we never asked them to okay, can we do this nicely, slowly, and drive, you know, and can you speak loud? Nothing like that. We just got in the car with the camera, and we just didn't have it, and we couldn't get that sense that these amazing teachers live, this is their life in the school. And then that drone shot, that tracking shot following their car, was quite late in the day, I think. You know, we actually thought,
this end of the summer,
the end of, yeah, we thought, you know, we've got to show away. And it kind of broke that cinema verite style, and we were kind of initially going, oh, you know, everything so just happens in front of the camera. Now, clearly, once you put a drone up in the sky, it's not just happening in front of the camera. You've got to set it up. So it was the only constructed shot in the entire 100 minutes of the film. But it's beautiful.
It is.
It's beautiful because they drive through, you know, and it's like the shot in The Shining, that opening
yes.
shot going through. The our film is not like The Shining.
No, it's very true.
Our film is very funny.
Yeah.
And positive.
Very true. So now you shot there for 2 years, and then basically, as you were kind of winnowing it down, you figured we're going to focus just on the second year for
yeah.
this. Was it what was it about the second year that kind of made you realize, like, this is what we want to kind of focus on?
Well, the first year really was material that, you know, we used to attract funders. It was sort of like assemblies, and also it was us kind of easing into the school and getting to know John and Amanda. And
getting to know the rituals and the routines
yeah.
and how the school worked. Now, we were filming that whole first year,
yeah.
but we actually, and at the time we thought we'd use it because there was some great characters and
yeah.
great stories. And then we felt like we hadn't really got it. And the funding, as I was saying, was a real struggle. Only came through at the end of that first year. And we thought, okay, we have a bit more money. Let's now do that second year. And it really was the right decision. But when we got to look at editing, it couldn't work. You know, to make 2 years look like 1 year
right.
would have been fake. To try and show 2 years in the life of school would have been huge. Kids changed. Some left. Some new ones came in. So we just decided... Right, that whole first year's footage
yeah.
in the bin.
Oh.
yeah.
It was heartbreaking. Heartbreaking, really.
Yeah.
But it was the right decision.
Is that something that, for like special features or anything, like that you put some of that material on?
Oh,
or is
yeah.
it just kind of just lost?
No. We will definitely pull
yeah.
some bits
yeah.
for...
Yeah, I mean, there were some lovely moments, of the younger kids especially, you know, like... you know, because we filmed with a lot of other teachers as well. And so there's more of the younger group in the first year of footage, but yeah, we'll find a space for that somehow or other.
Now, doing it with even observationally, still I feel like bringing a camera around kids, challenging it first for them to, like, don't worry about playing to the camera, you just do your own thing and we're just going to follow you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something easy for kids to kind of get along with?
Yeah, well, I mean, we made a decision that we were never going to, like, let a child know that we were focusing on them, because we didn't want them to have to carry that for the year. So we filmed with everybody, and we filmed a lot of stuff that we knew we weren't even going to use, really. But we just wanted the kids to be very free and not to feel in any way pressured. And also, we also realized that we couldn't become a distraction in the school day, because, you know, that would annoy the teachers, and, you know, we didn't want to be an annoyance. So we asked the headmaster if we could have a room in the school. So we went to school every day, just like the students did. So, you know, so it wasn't news that the film crew were in the school. So the kids
and the film
really
crew was just us.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was NASA doing camera and me doing sound. So
I
it
did
sounds
like
it sounds like, oh, the film crew. The
yeah.
film crew, no lights, just us.
Yeah.
You know, nothing extra.
Yeah.
Because I did like that at the end for your credit. It's a co-director and sound recorder.
Yeah.
I did,
yeah.
was like, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the children at that age, we're lucky. The children
yeah.
at that age, the first week or two, they were pulling faces at the camera, you know, boxing each other, just messy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just forgot about us, and completely forgot about us.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it was helped by the fact that we were parents, because our kids were day pupils.
Mm-hmm.
So they were. It was, oh, it's Tiger and Alia's mom and dad again with the camera, and they just forgot about us. It was wonderful.
Oh, that's
yeah.
nice.
Yeah. yeah. No, they were very generous. They really let us into their space, which was great.
And how do the parents and everything react if, like, you're going to come in and you're going to be documenting a year in the life of, you know, just every student,
mm-hmm.
and one of those happens to be my child as well? Were parents readily
they were very supportive, because they knew the
surprisingly
school was...
Surprisingly so.
Surprisingly,
yeah.
yeah.
We thought because it would be more difficult.
They knew that their children were flourishing and blossoming in the school, and they knew their children were happy there. So
mm.
they didn't doubt the school. And that when the headmaster and the school board supported the film, the parents came on as well. And, you know, we had to get permission and releases from all the parents, and they were amazing.
Mm. And then once we realized which children were going to feature most in the film, then we went back to those parents and made sure that they were okay with the storylines. And and again, thankfully, like, they were all happy.
Well, so speaking of the storylines, you ended up kind of focusing on Eliza and Teddy and Floria?
Flory.
Yeah. So Flory dealing with her self-confidence issues,
mm-hmm.
and Eliza with kind of her shyness,
mm-hmm.
and then Teddy with dyslexia.
Yeah.
What was it about those three, that those storylines, it's like those are the ones that we want to really kind of narrow down and explore through this film?
Mm. Well, first of all, they were taught by John and Amanda, which was important, because John and Amanda only really teach the older school kids. They were, in each of their own ways, Eliza is just so wonderful to watch. You know, you're just drawn to her because she's enigmatic. She's, you know, you want to know what's going on with her. Ted is just funny. he's
a big personality.
He's a great personality. And Florrie was just that slightly troubled kid who was already modeling in London, and you're kind of going, you know, child model, and I think Dermot says it, you know, it's a chance for her, the headmaster, it's a chance for her to get down and dirty at Headford.
And be a kid again.
Just to be a kid again. Yeah. So they emerged in the edit. We didn't follow them and say, you know, week one, Eliza, you know, 3 weeks later, we found Ted. Mm. We knew they were in their own way, they were personalities, but we didn't single them out. There were many other stories, wonderful stories that we didn't put in.
Yeah, but there was a nice arc there. There was a hurdle that they had to overcome. I mean, you know, there were other kids that were great characters too, but they were kind of perfect, so their storyline would have just been like this the whole way through. Mm-hmm. So, like, say,
or their storyline may have ended negatively, and we Nasser and I made a conscious decision that we wouldn't leave any of the children's storylines in a negative space. So we didn't want to leave it hanging with them that, you know, something hadn't been resolved or, you know.
Well, that was more with Eliza. Like, we took a chance with Eliza because we didn't know, like, we would never
didn't
have
know what was gonna
kept
happen.
Her suspended if she hadn't flourished at the end of the film. And, you know, and that was an amazing thing that it happened within a year. You know, like, that could have taken a lot longer than just 1 year. But it did happen. And she did flourish, so we did use it. But had she not changed, like, had she still remained the retiring, shy girl, you know, we would never have used that storyline, because she would have gone on in another year or two, and she, you know, things would have changed, and it would be wrong of us to suspend her in this film forever like that. So that was a big talking point, and we knew that we were taking a chance, you know, focusing on her.
But sort of the nice thing is, you said, by shooting as much as you did with all the kids, nobody's going to, the three of them aren't going to feel like self-conscious, like, start reacting, like, I got to, why are they focusing on me? What's interesting about me?
Well, exactly, because, like, when Ted's parents, you know, because we spoke to Ted's parents first about the dyslexia and were they comfortable with that, they went and said to Ted, like, you know, you're going to be featured in the film. And he was like, no, Mom, it couldn't possibly be. They hardly ever filmed with me. Like, he genuinely didn't think that there was any chance he would be a main character in the film.
And they brought Ted to the world premiere of the film, and the whole family, and the grandparents, brothers and sisters.
That's going to be excellent to see him kind of walking down the red carpet there. What I did like, though, is that that hearing John and Amanda talk about the students, it's always interesting. As a kid, you're always wondering, like, I wonder what teachers talk about. Do they talk about us when we're not around? To be able to hear that side and just kind of talking about, like, Eliza and just, like, you know, we see if we can get her out of her shell. Mm-hmm. Always interesting to hear about that. And it was really nice that they feel comfortable enough, the two of you. They're like, we can talk about how we'd really talk about these kids and not worry that you... And I feel uncomfortable about saying that in front of you.
Yeah.
Was that something for them to get comfortable doing? Or once they came to you and said, we're on board for this, what we see now is basically how they were the whole time. Mm.
Yeah.
Well, it was something that happened organically because, like, you know, there's two spaces where they kind of withdraw from the school and they have these private spaces at home. And then, you know, the smoking window.
Yes.
And, you know, and when we found them, it was just like we didn't really know about the smoking window until one day we just sort of followed them down these corridors and meandered to this private part of the school. And they just got on with what they normally did. Like, they didn't, you know, they didn't change anything. And that's where they had their conversations. And it was the same at home. You know, I mean, they always said to us, oh, no, we don't bring work home with us. So, you know, there's no big discussion, you know, but we were like, you know, well, can we come home with you? And of course, they continue talking about the kids because that's their absolute obsession, you know. And, you know, and you see how important each individual one of them is to them and how they, you know, mull over problems and they get upset if the child is upset and they get upset if they've upset the child and, you know, all those kind of things. So, you know. It was just really lucky that they were generous enough to trust us into those little private spaces because they made the film. You know, as you said, it's like getting that insight from their perspective. It's quite an intimate thing.
Absolutely.
And
just what I loved also is John's auditions for band. Just cuts him right off. Like, sing a few, that's it. Okay, next. I like that he just, he right from the beginning, he's just needling them right out of the gate. And just seeing how the children flourish over the course of this year, it's got to be remarkable. So seeing it, so you're already seeing it in your own kids, but then tracking these stories, not just for the three, but all the other children that you get, what was your experience like seeing, to answer that big question that you had, what is a 21st century boarding school like? What did you take away from this experience?
Well, that the children are given a huge amount of freedom, but in a safe way, you know. So they are allowed to climb trees, but not above a certain height. You know, they are allowed to go in and build forts and have pretend wars between each other, but they're not allowed to hit each other. You know, so and the school and John and Amanda encourage that independence and that freedom and that
the confidence
and also the ability to think. And to really kind of discuss things before you make a decision in the learning process. And Dermot Dix, the headmaster, is an expert at that. You know, he allows them the space to discuss and debate rather than saying, this is a fact, and this is what you need to know, and this is what you need to learn.
And this is how you need to think.
Yeah, which I like because he has that discussion with them about the same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
And just listening to all the kids' points of views, which even at a young age, interesting to see how some of them can just be just like, nope, this is what it's like. And see how he kind of starts picking that apart.
And that was a class on ethics and morality for 10-year-olds. I mean, isn't that wonderful?
It is.
You know, that you can have a man who's doing that and encouraging them to discuss and debate it by giving them a very real practical thing. Because there was the referendum on the Same-Sex Marriage Act happening in Ireland at the time. So, and that's what Dermot would do. He would bring current affairs in and get them to really think and discuss.
And they learn from each other, you know, and that's that I think that's what he really encouraged was, and you could see the children's like point of view shifting a little bit as this, you know, discussion went on, you know, and they'd be like, oh yeah, okay, I need to think about that, and why do I think this way about that, you know, because of course a lot of their opinions are inherited from somewhere.
Absolutely.
From their own communities, from their own families. So, you know, pushing them out there and making them talk about it amongst each other and amongst their peers, then, you know, they start learning about, well, hang on a minute, you know, how do I really think about this, or how do I really feel about this?
What I like about that is that it's not just challenging them to kind of open up their minds and think about things how they feel about it, but then giving them also teaching them the confidence as well to, once you kind of figure out what you think for yourself, be able to stand up tall and be
and
bold
it.
About that, yes.
Yeah. No, absolutely, and I mean, yeah, that's a big part of Headford, is instilling this kind of confidence, and it comes in mysterious ways sometimes. Like I remember John one time saying about our daughter, because our daughter would have been very quiet when she went to the school, you know, and he said, you know, Aelia was almost bold in class today. He was delightful, you know. I mean, it was just because he needles them, like he keeps trying to push them out of their comfort zone all the time. Like Eliza, this, you know, incredibly shy child, and he gets her up on stage playing with the band, you know, like he just keeps pushing them, going, come on, you can do a little more, a little more, a little more, and then you just see them like opening out, and it's great. And then by the end of the year, like they are just, you know, giving him back just as much as, you know, he gives them, you know, and it's really nice.
Now, the way that the film ends is there, it's kind of the end of the school year. Everybody's either, you know, moving on to different secondary schools or they're going to be coming back, but it's the end of the year. And, like, if you look at Ted, very emotional, and he's hugging everybody. But there's a shot right before, too, of Janet and Amanda, they're just kind of walking off. In the sense that they don't really kind of stick around to, as they said, they're not really in it for the glory at all.
No, they're not. And also, this is like they've had 46 years of those goodbyes, and you know they understand that they have to be detached to some extent. I mean, they love every one of those kids, and they remember everyone, and they'll remember someone who was there 30 years ago and be able to tell you stories about them. But they still have to. They couldn't not be a little bit detached. Every teacher has to do that, you know. We probably got much closer and fell more in love with the kids than the teachers did, because teachers know this is this year, next year I have a new group, I've got to treat that new group as individuals and teach them again.
Well, yeah, John talks about like how like there is that kind of, you know, that kind of, you know, sadness and nostalgia towards the end of the year. And he says, but then, you know, September comes and there are more kids who are going to fill their boots, and, you know, and you're going to help them kind of, you know, become these, you know, total human beings. So, yeah, I mean, he's, yeah, they're quite remarkable.
So now, of course, the talk was retirement. Talk was in the air, and as you mentioned, that Amanda was already looking for houses at the time. And John, of course, you know, what would he do if he was not doing this?
Yeah.
Has that changed since you finished shooting the film? Are they still there?
They are still there. They are still there. In fact, I had somebody. I met somebody last week, and she was like, my child is only two. Now, do you think they'll still be there? I'm just going, I hope so. I really hope so.
Oh, man. So now this, so you were at festivals and Magnolia Film Pictures picked up the film for distribution, and it's coming out in selected theaters here starting September 8th.
Yeah, yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah, so and now you're here stateside doing a promotion for this. What's the response been for from people for seeing how the school system works, say, in Ireland? Has it been like from an American point of view?
Well, I mean, I don't think that this film is a representation of how the school system works in Ireland, because it's quite a unique school. But I mean, from showing the film all around the world, we've had a lot of teachers have come to see it in Sydney, in Amsterdam, you know, in
Sheffield.
And all of them have responded so positively and so warmly to what they've seen in the film. And they've talked about how, you know, they wish they had that same potential and access to kids like, you know, John and Amanda have in a boarding school, because they have them for, you know, 24 hours a day. So, you know, there's a lot more. It's not just about, you know, getting the curriculum into them. You know, it's about other things, so that, you know, they have a lot more freedom than a lot of teachers would have, you know, who are sort of struggling to kind of just get through the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, teachers have responded to, you know, the play that's allowed to happen in this school. You know, the fact that they are allowed to climb trees, and also the fact that there's so little screen time. You know, the children don't use a lot of computers, or they don't have access to smartphones. You know, they have an ordinary little phone that they can ring their parents, you know, an hour a day, and that's it. And what comes out of that when children are liberated from, you know, being attached to a screen, I think, you know, teachers have responded really positively to that.
No, that's true. I mean, that's certainly the biggest change now, is just how accessible the internet or just, you know, your mobile phones or whatnot to kids of this age. And it becomes more of an insular experience, where before, if you didn't have access to those devices, then you've got to communicate with your...
Socialize. Absolutely. Yeah, and play games and, you know, learn from all of that. Yeah.
It's a fun part, being a kid. You want to play the games, right? Yes, I want to play games now. That's
go build a fort.
All right, that's what I'm doing afterwards here. So now you wrapped up this year doing some promotional work for this, but has already another question that you feel needs to be answered in a documentary, has that already kind of started working its way into your heads about your next project?
Yeah, we've got two projects that we're kind of developing at the moment, and they're quite different. They're not like the total immersion observational films, because I think, you know, it takes a while for that to surface, you know, to find the right environment that you
but
want to
fun.
Go into.
Well, one is fun.
One is fun and one is more serious.
And the fun one has lots of elements of like Indiana Jones type of escapades and a thriller and a search for hidden treasures and all that kind of thing. I'm not going to tell you any more about
it. No, that already sounds very cool.
Yeah, it'll be very different for us from what we've made in the past. But the great thing about school life is it's such a warm, positive film, and the reaction from people has been, this film makes you feel hopeful and optimistic.
Yeah.
And so, like, we kind of think, well, we should be making more films like that. So of the next two projects, while one is serious and deals with a quite important social issue, the other one will be lighter, and hopefully will also make people laugh and feel good about themselves and life.
Yeah, and, you know, and I think it's all about casting and finding really interesting characters that are going to reveal something, you know, important about life.
Well, you couldn't have found two more interesting characters than John and Amanda. Holy cow, what a gift to fall into your laps there for the two of them.
Yeah.
And I will say, as we're getting ready to wrap up, what I love, too, is about Amanda's classroom is just the amount of books all over on the shelves. Like, that right there just tells you, like, this is somebody that has been here for a while, and look at this collection.
And she inspires them to read. Kids as young as 7, 8 reading big, huge, you know, 300-400-word books and loving them, devouring them, you know. And she said to us once, the greatest gift you can give a child is teaching them to read or encouraging them to read.
Yeah.
And that's so true.
But at the same time, she says, never make a child read.
Never force a child.
Never make a child read, because it has to come from them. And so she really works on the older kids. And she said, if they see the older kids reading books, then the younger ones will follow.
That makes sense. If I could get my 4-year-old just to read more, I feel like I'm just reading more to her than she's reading it herself. That's my goal. I need to get a word to Amanda and John. It's that. Oh, like, yeah. Start working on them.
Book her in.
All right, that's it. All right, headed to Ireland.
You're
all
off
right.
to boarding school.
That's it. There you go. Send her across the way. Now it's opening up in selected theaters. You can check out, if they want to kind of follow up on where it's opening here nationwide, where's the best place to kind of keep up to date for school life?
I would say Magnolia's site and then our Facebook page. You know, our Twitter, you know, that kind of thing. But it's opening in 15 cities, so hopefully that'll give it a broad spread. And I think the way these things work is if the film's working and people like it, it's a great word-of-mouth film. People
yes.
will watch it, and they will go and tell their friends, their family, you have to see this. So we're hoping that, you know, it'll work and Magnolia will roll it out to 50,
more
60,
than, yeah.
100 cities. and everyone will have a chance to meet John and Amanda, which would be great.
Well worth the time there. I said, actually, one last question there is for the two of you, just curious, when you're actually, you've done the research for a project and you start shooting it, for example, with School Life, how far into the shooting do you realize, like, yep, we've got it? Like, we've done the research, of course, but when you're shooting, you're like, yes, this is it.
I don't think you ever do. You know, when you have to get to the edit suite, and even then, we had a year editing. We did test screenings, and every test screening, we were going, oh, God, you know, have we got it? And people said, this is magical, and we were going, okay, maybe it is, but, you know, maybe it's self-doubt. But you're never really sure, you know.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it gets invited to Sundance Film Festival, and you go, you know what? It must be quite good.
Yeah, I guess so. We did. We just made a great film. Look at that. Ladies and gentlemen, my guests have been Nyasa Nihian and David Rain. Look at that. I'm going to get that name right. I'm going to do it. Ladies and gentlemen, please follow this film. It is fantastic. John and Amanda are delightful characters. This is well worth your time. So if you're not in one of those selected 15 cities there, make sure you drive there, fly there, get to one of those cities. Or if not, make sure to be on the lookout for it when it does go to digital or iTunes, Amazon, be able to buy it that way too. It is, as I said, a credible documentary. So I've been your host here on Inside the Documentary. My name's Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. Until next time, we'll see you with another episode of Inside the Documentary right here on Popcorn Talk. Take care, everybody.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.